Attention painters, are you sick and tired of dealing with semi-reliable staff? Do you feel like you need to be on site all day because you can't trust your crew to do their damn job? Well, the reality is you probably have an accountability problem. And the bad news is you're babysitting your crews so much, it's hard to tell if you're running a painting business or a daycare. The good news is though, improving performance with your team is surprisingly easy to fix. Yes, even in your location and with your team size. Join me for a special web class July 8th. Where we'll show you how to eliminate all staff excuses, bringing one structured 30-minute meeting to life. This is gonna help you cultivate a reliable team without awkward conversations, conflicts, or festering resentment. July 8th, be there or be square. Click the link in the description. Let's register now and make it happen. Hey everyone, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. If you ever had to shop for software solutions, it kind of sucks. There's so much out there and everybody says that they're the best. That's why today I'm going to talk to James Benham. James is the CEO and co-founder of JBK, which offers technology solutions for insurance and construction companies. He's also the author of Be Your Own VC and founder of Contech Crew Podcast. Today's conversation is all about how to solve problems using the right technology, including how to pick which problem you're even trying to solve, how to research these solutions, often using actually AI, and tips to get your team to actually adopt the solution that you select. Before we get started, be sure to download your free tech stack tool in the link in the description, which will help you walk through some of the stuff that we talk about in today's podcast. So let's get started. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. James, welcome to our show. Thanks for being on. I know you're a busy human. You were telling me just about some of the things you're doing with the state, and now you're hanging out with me. So to respect your time, we got lots to get through today. I'll do my best to bring it to a concise point in the end, but I wanted to talk to you today just around like how someone should build their tech stack. I feel like a lot of the members we work with every day, they kind of build a bit of a mess, and it ends up being something that kind of half works, but there's a bunch of manual processes as well, and it's never quite what they imagined it to be. And They struggle to grow as a result. With that said, there's also a lot of opportunity in this industry right now, and there's a lot of new things coming out, as well as a lot of just solutions that, if made aware of, I think people could build a better tech stack. So I want to get into a lot of that with you today. But before we do, you've done a lot. I know you run JB Knowledge. You have 280 staff under there from the last time I read on your LinkedIn anyway. You run a podcast. You've got a book, Be Your Own VC. Curious to know, like, what connects all this work? What are you out there trying to achieve?
Well, I was first given a computer when I was 12 years old. I was 1991. I got a Gateway 2486. And the first thing I did with it wasn't play games. It was write code. I just got hooked on building software solutions and working with technology to change manual processes. At the time, I had a lawn mowing business, and I decided to automate my invoicing and receivables as a 12-year-old. And I remember I put an invoice on one of my lawn client's car windshield because he wasn't paying, and he goes, "What 12-year-old invoices somebody?" And I'm like, a 12-year-old who's not getting paid. And it just taught me a lot of valuable lessons early on that you can use technology to solve really, really big problems in the world. And that's what's motivated me ever since. You know, when I was 16, some friends of mine at school and I co-managed an internet service provider back in the mid-90s. And again, it was about solving people's problems connecting to the internet. Then when I got to college and did my internships with PricewaterhouseCoopers, I was paid to you know, build software and to hack into systems and then fix them so they couldn't be hacked into as an intern. It was a really fun 6 months between two internships, but it taught me that I really wanted to work in business to business, B2B software. And I really wanted to solve companies' problems with technology. And so in 2001, I started JB Knowledge. We call it JBK now, but it's I started JBK in 24 years ago. With a few thousand bucks in my dorm room. And again, same mission, solve big problems in the world with technology. And 2004, got into insurance, fell in love with the insurance sector, started building custom software to solve real world problems in insurance with claims and policies and inspections and you name it. And 2006, again, started building through random chance, got introduced to the construction industry. and found out that bidding was a really big problem for general contractors, that they needed a lot of help sending out invitations to bid. At the time, they were using an old DOS-based program called BidFax, or some you know, okay web-based solutions that really weren't that great. And so there was room in the market. And so we built a bidding system, and over 12 years got 250,000 companies to use it. You know, 11, so just under 1,200 major general contractors and 250,000 subs used it every day to bid work out. And again, the theme was solve real world problems. The real world problem was getting more bid coverage, getting more subs to respond. Subs wanted an easier solution to notify GCs of their intent to bid, submit their proposal, and download the plans. The GCs wanted an easier way to get to more subcontractors, get better bid coverage, and get better numbers, win more bids, right? The whole point was bid more work, win more work, and get quality subcontractors. And so we, for 12 years, did that, sold it in 2018, pivoted entirely into insurance. And again, the theme today with JBK and our product Terra is solving, you know, big real world business problems with cloud-based and, you know, cloud native, AI native solutions that are, you know, solving big problems for insurance companies around claims and policy. It's really the same thing. Like, I haven't really, I've been doing the same thing. We've been building, now I'm doing it with over 200 engineers. We've got 280 people in the company, and we get paid to build custom software. And we also have our off the shelf products. Again, all in the insurance sector. We have quite a few construction clients, by the way, because construction companies often form self-insured groups to insure parts of their operation. And so it, you know, by random chance, but I don't think it was random chance, we ended up in our insurance product business with two large builders groups that were two of our early clients. Again, solving certificate of insurance collection problems and solving claims and policy administration for their self-insured groups for their work comp pool. You know, it's over and over and over again, same theme. The world is filled with manual tasks. The world is filled with inefficiency. Humans are 24/7 waste generators, and technology backed by people and process helps solve that and improve efficiency and eliminate waste and make companies more money and reduce risk. You know, it's the same thing over and over and over again. And it's just really, really exciting. Of course, the tooling we use now is totally different. I mean, amazing. Totally different than 24 years ago.
Amazing. So what you're saying is your 12-year-old self, you solved the problem of getting invoiced out for your landscaping business. That part's done. You figured that part out. Okay, good.
You know, I did electronic invoicing for my landscaping business in 1992.
Amazing.
And it worked.
And you've just never stopped, my friend. So here's what's interesting. So I've watched this over the last 10 years. Technology has fundamentally transformed the contracting space. I'm curious to get your perspective on this, specifically in the last 10 years, and we'll talk a bit about the future as well, but what's been going on out there since, you know, let's say 2010 or 2015 to now? What are some of the big moves?
2010 is a good point.
Sure.
You know, my involvement in construction was particularly heavy from 2010 to 2020. You know, now my involvement with construction is really focused on risk management in the insurance sector for these construction self-insured groups and risk pools. From 2010 to 2020, we really got to witness the rise of contech. I mean, contech was really not even a phrase that we used until 2010. And you saw a really proliferation of at least hosted web-based solutions, not necessarily cloud native until maybe 2015, where you saw people building solutions explicitly designed to run in one of the major public clouds like AWS and Azure. But, you know, solution fragmentation, that was a big thing from really the advent of the iPhone 2007. It really kind of picked up big time steam in 2010, 11, where you started seeing, you know, going from no mobile apps. We were one of the first construction mobile apps in the App Store with SmartBid, our SmartBid mobile app. And that was in like 2010, maybe 2009. And you ended up, maybe it was even earlier than that, because the apps were, I think they started allowing apps in 2008 or 9, and we were there that first year. And you just saw a proliferation of solutions. So a lot of fragmentation. Contractors, instead of having two options of whatever it was at the time, let's say Sage, Timberline, or Viewpoint, or, you know, their big legacy ERP, they ended up with these point solutions. You know, PlanGrid came like a freight train into the industry, and along with a bunch of other products for timekeeping and invoicing and labor management, labor productivity, digital plans. BIM became a mobile app, not just a desktop application. There's a lot of things went to mobile because construction is a unique set of challenges, very different than an industry like insurance, where, most of the, not all, obviously there's field workers in insurance, there's field adjusters, there's field inspectors, but the vast majority of construction is in the field. And so they really thrive on mobile friendly solutions that are, synced through the cloud, work offline. It's a different set of requirements. And so that really hit hard. And about 2015, it really hit its stride. You saw a ton of consolidation and large players, Autodesk doing a lot of acquisitions and, Oracle getting hardcore into the construction space and acquiring a bunch of solutions. And so these major providers made big moves and app adoption went mainstream. And at the same time, you have younger people starting construction companies and saying, hey, we're going to be all digital from the ground up, And then, I think by 2015, you ended up with maybe 10% of construction companies that were legitimately not using paper plans. Mm-hmm. Now, the other 90% still were, and I don't even know what the numbers are now. I'm going to guess that still a vast majority still use paper plans and specs, even though there's absolutely no need to use paper plans and specs, and there's just a plethora of problems that come along with it. So it's been a really interesting ride to watch, the kind of the wave of innovation and fragmentation of small solutions and acquisition of those small solutions by the major ERP providers. And then of course, more point solutions being formed. And, we were part of that ride.
I still see it. Like when I go to a conference for roofing, I go down and I walk down the vendor aisles and I'm still seeing more new technologies come, more point solutions coming in, and it's confusing. And it's kind of like, okay, so which CRM should I use and which time tracker should I use? And some of them all have them all built in one, and some of them have that one feature I need. So maybe I'll just get them for that one feature. And you start to build a bit of a mess. Now, depending on the size of business, a lot of the ones I work with are $1 to $10 million. So they're not looking for these big enterprise solutions. They're working more in the smaller out of the box stuff. And I want to get into this a little bit today just to help navigate those business owners, those listeners. And I guess we would start just like, let's say I'm a contractor doing $4 million a year. I've got a mix of spreadsheets, outdated software, some manual processes. Where do I start? How do I start to navigate this?
I always said, walk around your organization, look for paper and Excel. That's always a good place to start. Excel's the cancer of construction. It always has been, and it probably always will be. Last time I checked, about half of construction companies' major critical processes were run in Microsoft Excel, from estimating to project management to scheduling. It's a challenge because Excel is great. And of course, Microsoft has enabled it further by cloud enabling Excel, putting it in Office 365, then tying in Power Apps. So you have Power Apps and Power BI, and they've made it easy to keep bastardizing the process. Excel and the Power Apps are great because you can do anything, and they're terrible because you can build anything. And if you're not careful, you can really mess up your operations. But I've seen companies do amazing stuff with Power Apps, Power BI, like really build soup to nuts end-to-end solutions for punch lists and time tracking and billing and, file sharing. The list goes on. There's really quite a few applications for all this. And so, I think you start by, in any organization, whether it's an insurance organization, a construction organization, any of them, you walk around and you watch people work and you say, why are you using that?
Right.
Like, why are you using that piece of paper?
Yeah.
Why are you using that Excel document? Why aren't you using the corporate approved application that we designated for that? Like, we have an estimating suite. Why are you using Excel? We have a project management suite. Why are you using a folder with plans in it and Excel templates, and once you start observing what people are doing, then you can start saying, okay, look, a lot of times a company's already picked a solution and people are just go rogue on their own because they don't know any better or they're willfully defiant. And so you got to work on bringing them into the fold. Yeah, in general, an all-in-one solution that does most of what you do is better than a bunch of point solutions that do everything that you need them to do. And here's why, because the point solutions almost never really integrate the way you want them to and bring all the data together. And so you're almost better off, don't let, what's the old phrase? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good enough. you know, that there's some all-in-one solutions that are good enough, and they'll get you there for your core critical applications. And then you can do bolt-on point solutions, but the failing strategy I've seen in multiple industries, but especially construction, has been the let the people pick what they want strategy, or let the local offices decide what they want strategy. I haven't really seen that work out well. It creates a wild fragmentation of solutions, a complete lack of standardization. Data security becomes a nightmare. And you have some offices that are super advanced and others that aren't advanced at all. And it's very, very challenging to get your hands around your data corporately, and reporting on all your data becomes impossible. So I do believe in a centralized technology planning organization for any company of any industry, so that you can, most importantly, can normalize your data and then do something with it and make better decisions with your data. And I do believe in picking an all-in-one that does 80% of what you need to do, rather than picking individual point solutions.
And I want to pick on something you said earlier. Like, it's almost like all these spreadsheets and manual processes and things happening, and if you have multiple offices and happening differently in all these offices, this is just R&D for you. This is like research and development for your basically process that you need to go out and define. And maybe it's all a little bit different, and maybe it's kind of good at the time that you used it, but at some level you need to analyze it and say, no, this isn't the solution anymore. This is just like an indicator of the features and the benefits and the processes we use that might that smell a certain way that we might need to match to an actual, like you said, all-in-one solution later on. So
Excel is a great R&D tool. It really is. It's a great prototyping solution. It's a great R&D tool. At some point it makes sense to have enterprise software. I mean, it's so much easier to build solutions. So because of AI and because of the ease of building point solutions with AI, you're going to see a proliferation of more and more and more point solutions every year, because it's really quick to build and spin off a mobile app that does one thing. And so you'll see a whole bunch of time tracking apps and a whole bunch of planned file sharing apps. But then when you get in, you get into the apps that really deliver a whole lot of value. They need to have a pretty robust set of feature functionality, a pretty complex interconnected set of features. You have to have this balance between ease of use and power, which is really kind of hard to walk the line on. A lot of proprietary in-house custom built apps on low code or no code platforms, like the Power Suite or there's a bunch out there now. The challenge with them is that you end up like with a kitchen sink design, because you don't have professional software designers designing them. And so you end up with a boatload of features. It can be kind of confusing, hard to use, so I tend to lean towards an Apple or a HubSpot approach, where you have maybe a cultivated walled garden where everything works exceedingly well, but you have less customizability, but you sacrifice the 100% power in exchange for an easier to use application.
Yeah. UX UI ends up mattering more sometimes than all the fun features. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything is user experience and user interface. I mean, and remember, user experience is the path you take to get somewhere. User interface is how pretty it is while you get there. So just remember, those are two different things. And they're two different skill sets. There's two different people inside my company. I have two different groups of people. I have people that do UX, people that do UI. But they matter so, so much in user adoption. In particular, when you have like a really disparate set of users, like construction companies do, you have a 60-year-old superintendent who's been in the field his whole life and doesn't like to use technology, but he's with the best builder you have. And then you have a 22-year-old engineering assistant who comes out of a college and can use any technology very easily and hates the old stuff, doesn't know much about the actual field problem. So you have a pretty wide array of users.
I find, as an entrepreneur myself, I have all these ideas and all these things that could be, and in my brain, they look so good. And then when you start to put them in front of your team, they're like, this is super confusing, bro. Like, we need simplicity. We need less is more. And so what you're saying, and I agree with this, so you're saying, go and get all the features and things that your team currently need, and then go out and find what percentage of this are we trying to like accomplish in an out-of-the-box solution? 50%? More than 50%?
No, I think it's like an 80-20 rule. Okay. I think you're trying to get 80% of the features accomplished, not 50. I mean, at 50, you're not going to get by on it. You're not going to meet the core critical system. But you got to find like on that feature list, 20% of the features are going to take 80% of the time. 80% of the features can solve the problem very effectively. Like you actually can spend an exponential amount of time solving 100% of the feature issues, and you can really complexify the product a lot.
Right.
you know, or let's use a real world, not complexify, which is not a word. Let's say you'll complicate the product a lot. And so, you know, I think that's the, what you got to say is, okay, what are the 80% of features, you know, of these 12 features, what are the 9 that have to be there? How do we cut some? And then even over those 9, maybe we're going to start the MVP out with what are the 6, what are the half of those that have to be in it for go live, and what 3 are we going to build after go live? You just got to remember, if you're only talking to 2 or 3 people, the likelihood that you're going to achieve product market fit, like the fit of your product with the market, even if the market is just internal users, is near zero. You've got to talk to dozens of users, dozens. I mean, you need to have a lot of open pain discovery. Open pain discovery is a process outlined really, really well in a book called The Unicorn Within. And, you know, it's really about asking the right 5 or 6 questions to a large number of people, like 100.
Give me some examples of this. The
question you can ask is, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and fix any problem, what would you do? That's the most important question you can ask. It's open-ended pain discovery. If you go to your internal users, and let's say you're deploying a technology solution just for internal use, and you go and say, look, here's the new tool. What do you think? Well, they're going to try and please you, because that's what people do. They're going to try and make you happy and tell you what you think they want to hear. If you go to them without showing them anything, you say, look, I'm part of a innovation team inside the company. I'm working to create a new innovative product, and we don't know what it is yet. So can you just tell me what your biggest pain point is? Okay, tell me what consumes your most manual time. Can you show me the paper documents and Excel spreadsheets you use? And then you get to that fourth question and you say, if you could wave a magic wand and fix anything, what would you fix? And that's going to be probably their biggest pain point. So you kind of get them conditioned up to it. And you ask these 4 or 5 questions, you do a 15-minute interview with 100 people, then you're going to get close to understanding the biggest pain point. And if you can solve your people's biggest number one pain point, then you have a really good chance of adopting a solution. It's also going to make you better at effectively selecting an off-the-shelf product, because hopefully there's an off-the-shelf product that solves that problem for your people. Versus having to build it.
You just rambled off 4 really good questions. Can you say them again for everyone listening? Because I think they're so simple, and I think they do exactly what you're talking about, which is not lead the witness and allow people to just tell you what they're really thinking, and you can start to see the pattern come out from it. What were those 4 questions again?
Yeah, it's just like, what are your biggest frustrations? You know, what processes, you know, causing the most problems? I mean, what paper and Excel documents do you use for what processes? And of course, the last one, if you can wave a magic wand and fix any problem, what would it be? By the way, I may have just changed the wording a little bit.
That's when okay.
I did that, because I'm not reading from a script. I'm just saying that that's really what you're trying to do, is just you're asking these open-ended questions, like, you know, what consumes the most time? You know, like that's a really good one. And what's your biggest pain in your butt? And then what's the always ask them, what do you use Excel and paper for? And then you jump into the magic wand question, which is, if you could wave a magic wand, which one, what would you fix and why?
Yeah,
those are nice open-ended questions that just, they keep you away. If you steer them, if you say, are checklists a problem? Yes or no? Well, they're probably going to say yes. I mean, if they have any idea of what you're trying to solve, they're going to want to please you and tell you what you want to hear. Right. It's the way people operate.
It's an old process I remember called the idea extraction that follows that same methodology when you're going out to the market and just looking to like build something from scratch and looking for pain points. So good. So we've basically like surveyed our team. We've looked at our manual processes. We made a big list. We started to prioritize that list based on some of those questions you've just said. Now we're going to go shopping. And how many providers do we want to look at? How do we shop? How do we do this?
I mean, shopping's hard. I mean, first, just finding the providers. I mean, luckily, there's provider directories on sites like Capterra and Software Advice. A lot of these have been rolled up and acquired. And they have, you know, directories of them. And if you're in the construction sector, they've got a directory of those products. And the same thing if you're in other industries. So I'd say go there, read the reviews on Software Advice and in Capterra, look at the different products, use Google. Although I have found Google to be far less useful. It's just chock full of ads and not full of a lot, not really full of organic results. It's really here. I think there's a reason that when ChatGPT came around, people abandoned Google so fast. Plus, I think Gemini sucks. So, like, I really like ChatGPT. I really like Claude AI. I would spend a good bit of time with AI at this point. Like, my answer to you is, like, when you're doing you know, tool selection, I would use the hell out of ChatGPT. I'd get a paid account of ChatGPT. I'd get a paid account of Claude. Both can search the web. I would have them be your research assistant and identify the top 10 solutions and then compare and contrast them, because they can index and read their websites and they can give you information and content. You can download PDFs off of all your solution providers' websites, upload it into ChatGPT or Claude, and then you can have it analyze and break down their features and do a comparison matrix. You can do what used to take us a substantial amount of time in a matter of minutes with a really good AI toolkit. And I would strongly advise you to leverage the heck out of that. I think you need to take a crack at 5 to 10 solutions for each category. Okay. I don't think 3 is enough. I think there's enough solutions now that you got to take a look at least 5, if not up to 10. Break it down and then, spend some time with the data from those solutions. And then at some point, you're going to have to get demos. Demos can be really time consuming. And so I would say that I default to, hey, let me try it first. A lot of providers won't do that unless you sit through an hour demo. But I like to get my hands on it.
If I
touch the software.
Yeah, I was going to say this too, actually. On ChatGPT, I went and got the pro mode, the $200 a month one. And that is, like, for what you just described, that is going to be worth your weight in gold. For those of you who are getting the free account or the $20 a month one, I think those help a ton. When I got the $200 a month one, I realized the amount of deep research that this thing will do in comparison is massive. And for what you just described, I feel like that would be the perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, like, we're not in the strategic consulting business anymore. I think strategy consultants are in really big trouble now, because ChatGPT is really, really good at idea generation and comparative analytics and comparing products. And again, you can upload 30 PDFs with brochureware from all your prospective solutions. It'll rip them apart and tell you all the information. You can get pricing sheets from all of them. It'll remember all of it. You can create a project for that in Claude. I mean, there's some cool stuff you can do. Of course, you can, if you got, Office 365, you can use Copilot, which is ChatGPT branded for Microsoft, whatever floats your boat. They're wonderful research assistants. They can help you. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to touch software. You have to do demos. You have to load some test data. And you cannot rely on AI to make the final decision. You're going to have to decide what works best for you. And if nothing works well for you, then you're going to have to decide what low code or no code platform to go build a custom application on.
Which I want to get into in a second, actually. I want to finish this thought, though. So we're getting now into demos and we're going to go through a bit of a sales process likely. What are, like, some really just good hard hitting questions that you find people don't ask till it's too late that you could recommend we ask when we're going through this process?
I'd say, what partners do you have that are already integrated, that are live with live data, and then have them tell you, and then say, show me. The hardest hitting question you can ask any software company is show me.
Right. Because they've got their demo environment marketing That's nice and clean, and it's just all perfectly set up to show you within the certain clicks that they go to.
No. Just say live. I want to see it live on the web browser, and then direct it. Say, hey, click there, show me. If they can't, you got a BS artist on your hands.
One thing I've actually found that's a little bit offside of just technology is how their support team works. Because I find that, like, if you don't have good support, if you can't get a hold of them when you need them, if you don't have good integration help, the whole thing could fall apart. And it's easy to not see that when you're just sitting there looking at a demo. You're not asking those types of things. But how have you found that side? I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. I mean, look, when you sign a software license, it's all subscription now. It's all cloud based, which means you're in a relationship with them. You're paying them every year, and you want it to be a good relationship. You're licensing their technology, but you're also buying into their support staff, and you're gonna need to get some help at some point. Now, look, there are products out there that you use without contacting support. I mean, you probably use Office and don't contact support. You probably use ChatGPT and don't contact support. You may even use something like QuickBooks and not contact support, but I mean, that's where it kind of stops. When you get into more complex enterprise applications, you're going to need to work with people, either an implementer to integrate all your custom home-built solutions with what you got, or, you're going to need some help, and that really matters as well. So I would say at least have an interview with the support staff, make sure that you can communicate with them well and that you like how they talk to you. You can just do a 15-30 minute session with them. You gotta talk to more than just the salespeople.
Okay. Now, you were starting to get into this, and there are times to build custom solutions. And I don't know if that's full, like, just add-ons or if that's full systems for the organization, but what size is a business when it starts to build custom? And what are they building custom? And when should you not?
Well, you should only explore a custom solution when you absolutely can't find the solution on the market and off-the-shelf software. Just in general, just remember that we see a lot of low-code, no-code solutions that still require engineers to put together. Okay? They still have to have an engineering mindset. They're complex. And a non-engineer going and building an application does not have a quality assurance mindset. They don't know how to test. They don't know how to do regression testing. They don't even know what that word means. They don't know how to do automated testing. They don't know how to really spec and do requirements and do a spec and then build to that spec. So I think if you're going to get into homegrown solutions, you need to have someone who's technically competent in-house or on retainer as a qualified consultant. And even then, it's just hard. Man, it's hard to get in as a small contractor or a small company of any type and have to maintain, because you have to maintain what you build. Even if it's in a easy to use, you're not doing any coding except dragging and dropping, you still have to maintain that solution. And when things break, you still have to fix it. You know, if your connector pipeline breaks or if your integration breaks, I mean, then you got a problem on your hands. And the other thing is that because you probably don't have quality assurance staff as a smaller company, you don't have testers, you don't have a way of actually validating that the data you're putting in is outputting correct information other than spinning up an Excel spreadsheet and running in parallel. And then again, you're not a pro tester, so you don't know how to test for edge cases and extremely rare circumstances. And I'd say I'd just be really careful about that. So I'd like to say in construction, I think you need to at least have 100 million in volume before you really get really serious about custom homegrown applications, because there's just a lot of stuff you got to deal with.
I see a lot of $3 to $5 million your businesses saying, we could do it. What could possibly go wrong?
They all say that. No. They say, look, and back in the day, they would say, I'm just going to hire a coder and have him go do it, which is fine too. I mean, look, I question whether we will really need low code or no code platforms in 5 years, because AI is getting really good at writing code, and you still, like, as good as it is, I've got 200 engineers working for me. They still need engineers assembling the pieces and putting it together and making sure it's quality controlled and tested and secure, where security is a big deal. And they'll say that, you know, oh, well, we can do it. My nephew's, he just graduated from college. He had a computer science degree. We'll hire him. He'll be fine. I mean, like, the minimum size team we put together to manage a software product is 4 people, you know, a quality assurance manager, a team lead and business analyst, and then 2 coders. And then we have to use fractional resources from data experts, a DBA or database team, user interface and experience people. I mean, it's like kind of home growing a car. Like, you know, if you home build a car or you actually get it professionally,
from Honda.
There's a vast difference in quality and testing and safety. Right. And so I just think that's just something you got to keep in mind is that, yeah, can you do it? Yeah, sure. Can you use Excel and Power Apps and do it? Yeah, absolutely. Can you reliably count on that information and data to be accurate, correct, secure, tested? Probably not. You know, and can the mistakes that are made in that kind of environment cost you your company? Absolutely. You know, saw it happen many times over the years.
So let's just follow our train of thought here. We've talked a little bit about, you know, identifying the problems, getting into some custom demos, asking some good questions, probably for most of our audience, unless you're 100 million or more, steering away from custom builds, essentially, like going with out-of-the-box solutions. Let's say you've now picked the thing you're going to use or the things. How do you ensure adoption? Because I also watched this happen where they finally sign the contract, the owner's excited, maybe even the implementer's next to them, and they're like, we're going to build this. And they do for 3 to 6 months, and then they roll it out to the team and no one uses it.
Well, you know, my favorite implementer of technology is a guy named Darren Roos. Call him the Rooster. He is a construction professional, probably the best I've ever seen at getting people to use software, because he made it like a game. He had a suit that he would wear that was a Pac-Man. It was literally, it was a Pac-Man game on a suit. He made everything a game. He made it fun. He first would educate and train people in the field and get their buy-in on why they were doing this and why they were using the software and explaining it and then demonstrating and then showing it and then putting their hands on it and conducting training sessions. But then he'd make it fun. I mean, you know, a story I've told a million times, you know, 10 years ago, he had a hard time getting field folks to use the BIM model that he had put together. And so he handed out a king size Snickers bar every day to the first person to find a 3D model of R2-D2 from Star Wars that he hid somewhere in the model every day. And it only took a couple of weeks, and everybody on the job site could use the model to navigate and find the solutions. And they stopped asking him to print off plan files. So I'd say, like, one of the biggest things about adoption is you've got to get creative. You know, you've got to be a creative solution provider, and ideally, you got to make it fun. You know, make it fun to learn, teach well, have a plan. I mean, sending it to the field and having them figure it out is not an adoption plan. But it is the one that is most commonly used. We're going to buy it, hand it to people, and they'll figure it out. Not a plan. Like, that's not a plan.
I was going to say, like, ideas aside, what you're saying is you actually have to put time into the, like, training and development of this. And I think a lot of people think it's a one-day meeting or a half-a-day meeting where everyone's sitting in the office and you do the overview with the screenshots and everyone's got maybe a version in their environment and they're playing for 3 hours. And then you're like, great, it's adopted, right? But no, there's a process over time of slow integration with each member on your team.
Yeah. And then you're going to have holdouts, and then you're going to have turnover. So people have to be retrained as new people come in. And then you're going to have upgrades and enhancements. I mean, the biggest problem in off-the-shelf software is underutilization of the off-the-shelf software. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest problem. It's like number one problem. And that's the number one problem for the solution providers. Trust me, as a solution provider, I'm telling you, our number one problem with our existing users is underutilization of the software. They only use, you know, half the critical features, and then they get frustrated because they don't know how to do the rest. And so, yeah, training's a beginning, middle, end all the time process. And, you know, the great organizations and, you know, the great general and subcontractors that we worked with had pretty robust training and support operations, dedicated staff that would train and support all the off-the-shelf solutions they offered as a company.
I was just going to ask you exactly that. What is the pattern? What's the common denominator with all your best adopters? And it's training. This is the number one thing.
Oh, yeah. Dedicated people. Yeah. Dedicated people focused on user adoption and training.
I'm curious, in your book, there's, I think, 10 principles. There's principle number 8. It says, make innovation a habit and a process. Is there a simple way for a contractor to make that a part of their day-to-day or their month-to-month? And just, I guess, essentially just like make sure that these things get adopted. Make sure they don't fall behind, because I think technology is moving faster than it ever has. How do we make innovation a part of our organization so we're not stuck using pen and paper? Like you said, 90% of us have been for so long.
Yeah, you know, I just, what I said in that chapter, and I provided some examples of construction companies and insurance companies and what they've done to really be truly innovative on a sustained basis. And largely it was, you know, innovation doesn't happen in your spare time. I say that in the book. It doesn't happen in your spare time. It can, but it usually doesn't. And so I say in their dedicated staff, space, and budgets, like have people that are dedicated to process improvement. You can call them your process improvement team. You can call them your process improvement person. You can call them your innovation team, but they go and observe users, identify behavior that needs to be improved, you know, so patterns and habits that need to be improved, and then either adopt existing solutions in a better way or adopt new solutions. And then they start over again. As soon as they're done with that, they move on to another problem. So, you know, making it a habit and a process means actually having a methodology they follow, having a dedicated team, a dedicated budget, dedicated staff and space, even if it's just like one person in an office and some tools, that's still better than most companies, because they can be really focused on visiting the field and visiting estimating and visiting BIM and getting their hands around what's going on. Again, this is why, you see large companies have some really advanced innovation efforts because they have the budget to assign a real team, not just one person. If you're a small company, you can actually start with just an intern. And I did when I was too small to have a full-time innovation team. I started by just hiring interns every semester and having them take a fresh set of eyes to a new set of problems and offer me solutions.
Yeah. You get, even as the entrepreneur, you get, I call it like windshield wiper syndrome, where you're off looking in the distance and you don't see what's obviously right in front of you. And having somebody come in fresh will probably identify some obvious things. You're like, well, duh. It's just,
yeah,
we've always done it that way. Cool. Okay. That's awesome. There's a lot there. I think, thank you for just helping all of us just walk through a little bit of the stages and what's best practice throughout. I know there's so much more you can get into, but for the sake of time and today, I guess there's things to make people aware of where we're going in the next 5 years. What are some of the biggest mistakes or opportunities we have ahead of us? And just things you should make our audience aware of.
One of the things I've seen in every industry I've worked in, particularly in construction, is a reticence, reluctance to adopt solutions now because they're worried about them being obsolete in 2 years. I've seen that a lot, where they arrive at paralysis by analysis and they don't want to continue innovating. Because they're worried about, hey, this solution might not be the best solution 2 years from now. I think that's probably one of the biggest pitfalls. You got to stop that and just say, hey, look, what's the best solution right now? Because if this solution has a 2 month ROI, like what we spend on it for a year subscription, we make back in 2 months, who cares what you're doing 2 years from now? Like if you can context and frame it in a 2 year perspective, then great. If you can have a central strategy where you're going to bolt together applications over a multi-year period, great. Remember that the technology industry moves very quickly. Solutions come on and off the market and get acquired very quickly. And so you've got to make the best decisions you can today with what you got and really fight the paralysis by analysis temptation and fight the temptation to not adopt solutions because you're worried about them being rendered obsolete. I mean, the reality is a lot of the solutions that people said were going to be obsolete in a year or two are still very popular and very much on the market because people don't like change. And so, you might really be misreading the room or the future. And so you don't want to miss out on returns that you can have right now from adopting technology.
I find it also like forces you to learn your process. I think for a lot of the businesses we work with that are a little smaller, like they have yet to fully define what their process even is. And it forces that function to be like, you now have to figure out how the sandwich gets made. And you're like, but it's always been in my head. And you're like, not anymore. So like,
yeah, SOMP, seat in my pants is not a process.
Yeah.
You know, figuring it out in the field is not a process. Unless it's known by all, followed by all and documented, it's not a standard process.
It's good accountability.
So, yeah. Yeah, it's a forcing function. Technology is always a forcing function for defining process.
Awesome. James, let's stop it there. Just final thoughts. Where can people connect with you if they wanted to connect with you online, read your book? What's the best way to people reach out to you?
Yeah, easiest place is jamesbenham.com. That's J-A-M-E-S, B as in boy, E-N-H-A-M, jamesbenham.com. You can go there, download the book. You can go connect to me on LinkedIn, Instagram. You can follow my videos on YouTube. You can download the book through Audible or through Amazon. You can sign up for my weekly or my monthly newsletter. I mean, it's on the website. I send out little thoughts on bootstrapped innovation and the newsletter. So it's all on jamesbenham.com. You can check it out. My company, JBK, is at jbknowledge.com. My product, Terra, which is a risk management suite, is at terra.insure. So that's the long and short of it. Would love to engage with you on social media.
Beauty. Okay. Thank you for your time, James.
Thanks for yours. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.